Chapter 3, My Abyss, 1979 to 1982. From 1950 until 1980, debt, inflation, and growth moved up and down together in steadily larger waves, with each bigger than the one before, especially after the dollar's link to gold was broken in 1971. In the 1970s, there were three such waves. The first came in 1971 as a result of the dollar's devaluation. The second, which came between 1974 and 75, took inflation to the highest level since World War II. The Fed tightened the money supply, driving interest rates to record highs and causing the worst stock market and economic downturn since the 1930s. The third and largest wave came in 1979 to 1982 and was one of the greatest economic market crescendos and reversals since 1929 to 32. Interest rates and inflation rates soared and crashed. Stocks, bonds, commodities, and currencies went through one of the most volatile periods ever, and the unemployment rate hit the highest level since the Great Depression. It was a time of extreme turbulence for the economy, for the markets, and for me personally. In 1978 to 1980, as in 1970 to 71 and 1974 to 75, different markets began to move in unison because they were more influenced by big swings in money and credit growth than by changes in their individual supply-demand balances. These big moves were exacerbated by the oil shock that followed the fall of the Shah of Iran. That oil market volatility led to the creation of the first oil futures contract, which gave me trading opportunities. By then, there were futures markets in interest rates and currencies as well, and I was making bets in all of them. Because all the markets were being driven by these factors, I immersed myself in macroeconomics and historical data, especially interest rates and currency data, to improve my understanding of the machine at play. As inflation began to rise in 1978, I realized the Fed would likely act to tighten the monetary supply. By July 1979, inflation was clearly out of control, and President Carter appointed Paul Volcker chairman of the Federal Reserve. A few months later, Volcker announced that the Fed would limit the growth of the money supply to 5.5%. According to my calculations, 5.5% money growth would break the inflation spiral, but it would also strangle the economy and the markets and likely cause a catastrophic debt crisis. A silver roller coaster. Just before Thanksgiving, I met with Bunker Hunt, then the richest man in the world, at the Petroleum Club in Dallas. Bud Dillard, a Texan friend and client of mine, who was big in the oil and cattle business, had introduced us a couple of years before, and we regularly talked about the economy and markets, especially about inflation. Just a few weeks before our meeting, Iranian militants had stormed the U.S. Embassy in Tehran, taking 52 Americans hostage. There were long lines to buy gas and extreme market volatility. There was clearly a sense of crisis. The nation was confused, frustrated, and angry. Bunker Hunt saw the debt crisis and inflation risks pretty much as I saw them. He'd been wanting to get his wealth out of paper money for the past few years, so he'd been buying commodities, especially silver, which he had started purchasing at about $1.29 an ounce as a hedge against inflation. He kept buying and buying as inflation and the price of silver went up until he had essentially cornered the silver market. At that point, silver was trading at around $10. I told him I thought it would be a good time to get out because the Fed was becoming tight enough to raise short-term interest rates above long-term rates, which was called inverting the yield curve. Every time that happened, inflation-hedged assets and the economy went down. But Bunker was in the oil business, and the Middle East oil producers he talked to still worried about the depreciation of the dollar. They had told him that they were going to buy silver as a hedge against inflation, so he held on to it in the expectation that its price would continue to rise. I got out. On December 8, 1979, Barbara and I had our second son, Paul. Everything changed very fast, but I love the intensity of it. By early 1980, silver had gone to nearly $50, and as rich as he was, Bunker became a lot richer. While I had made a lot of money on silver's rise to $10, I was kicking myself for missing the ride to $50. But at least by being out, I didn't lose money. There are anxious times in every investor's career when your expectations of what should be happening aren't in line with what is happening, and you don't know if you're looking at great opportunities or at catastrophic mistakes. Because I had a strong tendency to be right but early, I was inclined to think that that was the case. It was. But to have missed the $40 move up was inexcusable to me. When the plunge finally did happen, in March 1980, silver crashed back to below $11. It ruined Bunker Hunt, and it nearly brought down the whole U.S. economy as he fell. The Fed had to intervene to control the ripple effects. All of this pounded an indelible lesson into my head. Timing is everything. I was relieved that I was out of the market, but watching the richest man in the world, who also was someone I empathized with, go broke was jarring. Yet it was nothing compared to what was to come next. Expanding the team. Later that same year, a guy named Paul Coleman joined Bridgewater. We had become good friends from our dealings in the cattle and beef industry, and I respected his intellect and values, so I convinced him we should conquer the world together. He brought his wonderful wife and kids up from Guymon, Oklahoma, and our families became inseparable. We ran the business in a scrappy seat-of-the-pants sort of way. Because the office part of the brownstone where I lived and worked was generally such a mess with chicken bones or other scraps from working through the previous night's dinner littering my desk, we held our client meetings at the Harvard Club. Paul would hide a clean blue Oxford shirt and tie amid the mess so I'd have something to wear. In 1981, we decided we wanted to raise our families in more of a country setting, so we moved to Wilton, Connecticut, to run Bridgewater from there. Coleman and I worked by challenging each other's ideas and trying to find the best answers. It was a constant back and forth, which we both enjoyed, especially at a time when there was so much to figure out. We would debate about the markets and the forces behind them late into the night, plug data into the computer before we went to bed, and see what it would spit out in the morning. My Big Depression Call. The economy was in even worse shape in 1979-81 than it was during the financial crisis of 2007-08, and the markets were more volatile. In fact, some would say that this was the most volatile period ever. It was one of the most pivotal times in the last 100 years. The political pendulum throughout the world swung to the right, bringing Margaret Thatcher, Ronald Reagan, and Helmut Kohl to power. Liberal had ceased to mean being in favor of progress and had come to mean paying people not to work. As I saw it, the Fed was stuck between a rock and a hard place. They either had to print money to relieve the debt problems and keep the economy going, which had already pushed inflation to 10% in 1981 and was causing people to dump bonds and buy inflation hedge assets, or they had to break the back of inflation by becoming bone-crushing tight, which would break the back of debtors because debt was the highest level since the Great Depression. The worsening problem showed up in progressively higher levels of inflation and progressively worse levels of economic activity. Both appeared to be coming to a head. Debts continued to rise much faster than the incomes borrowers needed to repay them, and American banks were lending huge amounts, much more than they had in capital, to emerging countries. In March of 1981, I wrote a daily observation entitled "The Next Depression in Perspective," and concluded it by saying, "The enormity of our debt implies that the depression will be as bad or worse than we witnessed in the 1930s. This view was extremely controversial. To most people, depression was a scary word used by kooky, sensationalist people, not something thoughtful people took seriously. But I had studied debt and depressions back to 1800, done my calculations, and was confident that the debt crisis led by emerging countries was coming. I had to share my thinking with my clients. Because my views were so controversial, I asked others to track my reasoning and point out to me where it was bad. No one could find any flaws in my logic, though they were all reluctant to endorse my conclusion. Because I believed that the choice was between accelerating inflation and deflationary depression, I was holding both gold, which performs well in accelerating inflation, and bonds, which perform well in deflationary depressions. Up until that point, gold and bonds moved in opposite directions, depending on whether inflation expectations rose or fell. Holding these positions seemed much safer than holding alternatives like cash, which would lose value in an inflation environment, or stocks, which would crash in a depression. At first, the markets went against me, but my experience with silver and other trades had taught me that I had a chronic problem with timing, so I believed that I was just early and what I was expecting would happen soon. That didn't take long to happen. By the fall of 1981, the tight Fed policies were having a devastating effect. My bond bets were beginning to pay off, and my kooky views were starting to look right on. In February 1982, the Fed temporarily added liquidity to avoid a cash crunch. In June, as the scramble for liquidity intensified, the Fed responded by printing money, increasing liquidity to its highest level since Paul Volcker's appointment. But it still wasn't enough. The greatest whipsaw ever. In 1982, Mexico defaulted on its debt. By then, it was clear to most everyone that a number of other countries were about to follow. This was a huge deal because U.S. banks had lent about 250% of their capital to other countries just as at risk as Mexico. Business loan activity in the U.S. ground to a halt. Because I was one of the few people who had seen these things coming, I started to get a lot of attention. Congress was holding hearings on the crisis and invited me to testify. In November, I was featured on Wall Street Week with Louis Rukeyser, the must-watch show for anyone in the markets. In both appearances, I confidently declared that we were headed for depression and explained why. After Mexico's default, the Fed responded to the economic collapse and debt defaults by making money more readily available. This caused the stock market to jump by a record amount. While that surprised me, I interpreted it as a knee-jerk reaction to the Fed's move. After all, in 1929, A 15% rally was followed by the greatest crash of all time. In October, I laid out my prognosis in a memo. As I saw it, there was a 75% chance the Fed's efforts would fall short and the economy would move into failure. A 20% chance it would initially succeed at stimulating the economy, but still ultimately fail. And a 5% chance it would provide enough stimulus to save the economy, but trigger hyperinflation. To hedge against the worst possibilities, I bought gold and Treasury bill futures as a spread against Eurodollar futures, which was a limited risk way of betting on credit problems increasing. I was dead wrong. After a delay, the economy responded to the Fed's efforts, rebounding in a non-inflationary way. In other words, inflation fell while growth accelerated. The stock market began a big bull run, and over the next 18 years, the U.S. economy enjoyed the greatest non-inflationary growth period in history. How was that possible? Eventually, I figured it out. As money poured out of these borrower countries and into the U.S., it changed everything. It drove the dollar up, which produced deflationary pressures in the U.S., which allowed the Fed to ease interest rates without raising inflation. This fueled a boom. The banks were protected both because the Federal Reserve loaned them cash and the creditors' committees and international financial restructuring organizations, such as the International Monetary Fund and the Bank for International Settlements, arranged things so that the debtor nations could pay their debt service from new loans. That way, everyone could pretend everything was fine and write down those loans over many years. My experience over this period was like a series of blows to the head with a baseball bat. Being so wrong, and especially so publicly wrong, was incredibly humbling and cost me just about everything I had built at Bridgewater. I saw that I had been an arrogant jerk who was totally confident in a totally incorrect view. So there I was, after 8 years in business, with nothing to show for it. Though I'd been right much more than I'd been wrong, I was all the way back to square one. At one point, I'd lost so much money I couldn't afford to pay the people who worked for me. One by one, I had to let them go. We went down to two employees, Coleman and me. Then Coleman had to go. With tears from it all, his family packed up and returned to Oklahoma. Bridgewater was now down to just one employee, me. Losing people I cared so much about, and very nearly losing my dream of working for myself, was devastating. To make ends meet, I even had to borrow $4,000 from my dad until we could sell our second car. I had come to a fork in the road. Should I put on a tie and take a job on Wall Street? That was not the life I wanted. On the other hand, I had a wife and two young children to support. I realized I was facing one of life's big turning points, and my choices would have big implications for me and for my family's future. Finding a way past my intractable investment problem. Making money in the markets is tough. The brilliant trader and investor Bernard Baruch put it well when he said, "If you are ready to give up everything else and study the whole history and background of the market and all principal companies whose stocks are on the board as carefully as a medical student studies anatomy, if you can do all that, and in addition, you have the cool nerves of a gambler, the sixth sense of a clairvoyant, and the courage of a lion, you have a ghost of a chance." In retrospect, the mistakes that led to my crash seemed embarrassingly obvious. First, I had been wildly overconfident and let my emotions get the better of me. I learned, again, that no matter how much I knew and how hard I worked, I could never be certain enough to proclaim things like I had on Wall Street Week. There would be no soft landing. I could say with absolute certainty, because I know how markets work. I am still shocked and embarrassed at how arrogant I was. Second, I saw the value of studying history. What had happened, after all, was another one of those. I should have realized that debts denominated in one's own currency can be successfully restructured with the help of the government, and that when central banks simultaneously provide stimulus, as they did in March 1932 at the low point of the Depression, and they did again in 1982, inflation and deflation can be balanced against each other. As in 1971, I had failed to recognize the lessons of history. Realizing that made me try to make sense of all movements in all major economies and markets going back 100 years, and to come up with carefully tested decision-making principles that are timeless and universal. Third, I was reminded how difficult it is to time markets. My long-term estimates of equilibrium levels were not reliable enough to bet on. Too many things could happen between the time I placed my bets and the time, if ever, that my estimates were reached. Staring at these failures, I realized that if I was going to move forward without a high likelihood of getting whacked again, I would have to look at myself objectively and change, starting by learning a better way of handling the natural aggressiveness I've always shown in going after what I wanted. Imagine that, in order to have a great life, you have to cross a dangerous jungle. You can stay safe where you are and have an ordinary life, or you can risk crossing the jungle to have a terrific life. How would you approach that choice? Take a moment to think about it, because it's the sort of choice that in one way or another we all have to make. Even after my crash, I knew that I had to go after the terrific life with all of its risk. So the question was, how to cross the dangerous jungle without getting killed? In retrospect, my crash was one of the best things that ever happened to me, because it gave me the humility I needed to balance with my aggressiveness. I learned a great fear of being wrong that shifted my mindset from thinking, I'm right, to asking myself, how do I know I'm right? And I saw clearly that the best way to answer this question is by finding other independent thinkers who are on the same mission as me and who see things differently from me. By engaging them in thoughtful disagreement, I'd be able to understand their reasoning and have them stress test mine. That way we can raise all of our probabilities of being right. In other words, I just wanted to be right. I didn't care if the answers came from me. So I learned to be radically open-minded to allow others to point out what I might be missing. I saw that the only way I could succeed was, 1, seek out the smartest people who disagreed with me so I could try to understand their reasoning. 2, know when not to have an opinion. 3, develop, test, and systemize timeless and universal principles. And 4, balance risks in ways that keep the big upside while reducing the downside. Doing these things significantly improved my returns relative to my risks, and the same principles apply in other aspects of life. Most importantly, it led me to build Bridgewater as an idea meritocracy, not an autocracy in which I would lead and others would follow, and not a democracy in which everyone's vote is equal, but a meritocracy that encourages thoughtful disagreements and explores and weighs people's opinions in proportion to their merits. Bringing these opposing opinions into the open and exploring them taught me a lot about how people think. I came to see that people's greatest weaknesses are the flip sides of their greatest strengths. For example, some people are prone to take on too much risk, while others are too risk-averse. Some are too focused on the details, while others are too focused on the big picture. Most are too much one way and not enough the other. Typically, by doing what comes naturally to us, we fail to account for our weaknesses, which leads us to crash. What happens after we crash is most important. Successful people change in ways that allow them to continue to take advantage of their strengths while compensating for their weaknesses, and unsuccessful people don't do that. Later in this audiobook, I will describe specific strategies for change, but the important thing to note here is that beneficial change begins when you can acknowledge and even embrace your weaknesses. Over the years that followed, I found that most of the extraordinarily successful people I met had similar big painful failures that taught them the lessons that ultimately helped them to succeed. Looking back on getting fired from Apple in 1985, Steve Jobs said, "It was awful tasting medicine, but I guess the patient needed it." Sometimes life hits you in the head with a brick. Don't lose faith. I'm convinced that the only thing that kept me going was that I loved what I did. That's Steve Jobs. I saw that to do exceptionally well, you have to push your limits, and that if you push your limits, you will crash, and it will hurt a lot. You will think you have failed, but that won't be true unless you give up. Believe it or not, your pain will fade, and you will have many other opportunities ahead of you, though you might not see them at the time. The most important thing you can do is gather the lessons these failures provide and gain humility and radical open-mindedness in order to increase your chances of success. Then you press on. My final lesson was perhaps the most important one because it applied again and again throughout my life. At first, it seemed to me that I faced an all-or-nothing choice. I could either take a lot of risk in pursuing high returns and occasionally find myself ruined, or I could lower my risk and settle for lower returns. But I needed to have both low risk and high returns, and by setting out on a mission to discover how I could, I learned to go slowly when faced with the choice between two things that you need and that are seemingly at odds. That way you can figure out how to have as much of both as possible. There is almost always a good path that you just haven't discovered yet. So you have to look for it until you find it, rather than settle for the choice that is then apparent to you. As difficult as this was, I eventually found a way to have my cake and eat it too. I call it the Holy Grail of investing, and it's the secret behind Bridgewater's success.